Bring up the bodies. Disc 11.
By the time he gets to Francis Weston, right hindpaw, he has been approached by the young man's family and offered a great deal of money. Politely, he has refused them. In their circumstances, he would do just the same, except that it is hard to imagine Gregory, or any member of his household, to be such a fool as this young man has been. The Weston family go further. They approach the king himself. They will make an offering. They will make a benevolence. They will make a large and unconditional donation to the king's treasury. He discusses it with Fitzwilliam. I cannot advise His Majesty. It is possible that lesser charges can be brought. It depends how much His Majesty thinks his honour is touched. But the king is not disposed to be lenient. Fitzwilliam says grimly, If I were Weston's people, I would pay the money anyway, to ensure favour. Afterwards. That is the very approach he has settled on himself, thinking of the Boleyn family, those who survive, and the Howards. He will shake the ancestral oaks, and gold coins will drop each season. Even before he comes to the room where Weston is held, the young man knows what to expect. He knows who is jailed with him. He knows or has a good idea of the charges. His jailers must have babbled because he, Cromwell, has cut off communication between the four men. A talkative jailer can be useful. He can nudge a prisoner towards cooperation, towards acceptance, towards despair. Weston must guess his family's initiative has failed. You look at Cromwell and you think, if bribery won't do it, nothing else will. It's useless to protest or disclaim or contradict. Abasement might just do it, it's worth a try. I taunted you, sir, Francis says. I belittled you. I am sorry I ever did so. You are the king's servant, and it was proper for me to respect that. Well, that is a handsome apology, he says, though you should beg forgiveness of the king and of Jesus Christ. Francis says, You know I am not long married, and your wife left at home in the country, for obvious reasons. Can I write to her? I have a son. He is not yet a year. A silence. I wish my soul to be prayed for after I am dead. He would have thought God could make his own decisions, but Weston believes the Creator may be pushed and coaxed and maybe bribed a little. As if following his thought, Weston says, I am in debt, Master Secretary. To the tune of £1,000, I am sorry for it now. No one expects a gallant young gentleman like yourself to be thrifty. His tone is kindly, and Weston looks up. Of course, these debts are more than you could reasonably pay, and even set against the assets you will have when your father dies, they are a heavy burden. So your extravagance gives people to think, what expectations had young Weston? For a moment, the young man looks at him with a dumb, rebellious expression, as if he does not see why this should be brought against him. What have his debts to do with anything? He does not see where it is leading. Then he does. He, Cromwell, puts out a hand to grab his clothes to stop him slumping forward in shock. A jury will easily grasp the point. We know the Queen gave you money. How could you live as you did? It is easy to see. £1,000 is nothing to you if you hoped to marry her once you had contrived the King's death. When he is sure that Weston can sit upright, he opens his fist and eases his grip. Mechanically, the boy reaches up and straightens his clothes, straightens the little ruff of his shirt collar. Your wife will be taken care of, he tells him. Have no unease on that score. The king never extends animosity to widows. She will be cared for better, I dare say, than you ever cared for her. Weston looks up. I cannot fault your reasoning. I see how it will weigh when it is given in evidence. I have been a fool, and you have stood by and seen it all. I know how I have undone myself. I cannot fault your conduct either, because I would have injured you if I could, and I know I have not lived a good... I have not lived... You see, I thought I should have another 20 years or more to live as I have, and then when I am old, 45 or 50, I should give to hospitals and endow a chantry, and God would see I was sorry. He nods. "Well, Francis," he says, "we know not the hour, do we? But, Master Secretary, you know that whatever wrong I have done, I am not guilty in this matter of the Queen. I see by your face you know it. And all the people will know it too when I am brought out to die. And the King will know it and think about it in his private hours. I shall be remembered, therefore, as the innocents are remembered." It would be cruel to disturb that belief. He looks to his death to give him greater fame than his life has done. All the years that stretched before him, and no reason to believe that he meant to make any better use of them than he made of the first 25. He himself says not. Brought up under the wing of his sovereign, a courtier since he was a child, from a family of courtiers, never a moment's doubt about his place in the world, never a moment's anxiety, never a moment's thankfulness for the great privilege of having been born Francis Weston, born in the eye of fortune, born to serve a great king and a great nation. He will leave nothing but his debt, and a tarnished name, and a son. "And anyone can father a son," he says to himself, "until he remembers why we are here and what all this is about." He says, "Your wife has written for you to the king, asking for mercy. You have a great many friends. Much good they will do me. I do not think you realize that at this juncture many men would find themselves alone. It should cheer you. You should not be bitter, Francis. Fortune is fickle, every young adventurer knows that. Resign yourself. Regard Norris. No bitterness there." "Perhaps," the young man blurts, "perhaps Norris thinks he has no reason for bitterness. Perhaps his regrets are honest ones and necessary. Perhaps he deserves to die as I do not." "He is well paid out, you think, for meddling with the Queen. He is always in her company. It is not to discuss the gospel." He is perhaps on the verge of a denunciation. Norris had begun on some admission to William Fitzwilliam, but he bit it back. Perhaps the facts will come out now. He waits, sees the boy's head sink into his hands. Then, impelled by something, he does not know what, he stands up, says, "Francis, excuse me," and walks out of the room. Outside, Risley is waiting, with gentlemen of his household. They are leaning against the wall, sharing some joke. They stir at the sight of him, look expectant. "Are we finished?" Risley says. "He has confessed?" He shakes his head. "Each man will give a good account of himself, but he will not absolve his fellows. Also, they will all say, 'I am innocent.' But they do not say, 'She is innocent.' They are not able. It may be she is, but none of them will give his word on it." It is just as Wyatt once told him. "The worst of it is," he had said, "her hinting to me, her boasting almost, that she says no to me, but yes to others." "Well, you have no confessions," Risley says. "Do you want us to get them?" He gives Call Me a look that knocks him back, so he steps on the foot of Richard Rich. "What, Risley? Do you think I am too soft to the young?" Rich rubs his foot. "Shall we draw up specimen charges?" "The more the merrier. Forgive me. I need a moment." Rich assumes he has gone out to piss. He does not know what caused him to break off from Weston and walk out. Perhaps it was when the boy said 45 or 50. As if, past mid-life, there is a second childhood, a new phase of innocence. It touched him, perhaps, the simplicity of it. Or perhaps he just needed air. Let us say you are in a chamber, the windows sealed, you are conscious of the proximity of other bodies, of the declining light. In the room you put cases, you play games, you move your personnel around each other. Notional bodies, hard as ivory, black as ebony, pushed on their paths across the squares. Then you say, "I can't endure this any more. I must breathe." You burst out of the room and into a wild garden where the guilty are hanging from trees, no longer ivory, no longer ebony, but flesh, and their wild, lamenting tongues proclaim their guilt as they die. In this matter, cause has been preceded by effect. What you dreamed has enacted itself. You reach for a blade, but the blood is already shed. The lambs have butchered and eaten themselves. They have brought knives to the table, carved themselves, and picked their own bones clean. May is blossoming even in the city streets. He takes flowers in to the ladies in the tower. Christophe has to carry the bouquets. The boy is filling out and looks like a bull garlanded for sacrifice. He wonders what they did with their sacrifices, the pagans and the Jews of the Old Testament. Surely they would not waste fresh meat, but give it to the poor. Anne is housed in the suite of rooms that were redecorated for her coronation. He himself had overseen the work, and watched as goddesses, with their soft and brilliant dark eyes, blossomed on the walls. They bask in sunlit groves under cypress trees. A white doe peeps through foliage while the hunters head off in another direction, and hounds lollop ahead of them, making their hound music. Lady Kingston rises to greet him, and he says, "Sit down, dear madam." Where is Anne? Not here in her presence chamber. "She is praying," one of the Boleyn aunts says, "so we left her to it." "She has been a while," the other aunt says. "Are we sure she hasn't got a man in there?" The aunts giggle. He does not join them. Lady Kingston gives them a hard look. The Queen emerges from the little oratory. She has heard his voice. Sunlight strikes her face. It is true what Lady Rochford says. She has begun to line. If you did not know she was a woman who had held a king's heart in her hand, you would take her for a very ordinary person. He supposes there will always be a strained levity in her, a practiced coyness. She will be one of those women who at 50 thinks she is still in the game, one of those tired old experts in innuendo, women who simper like maids and put their hand on your arm, who exchange glances with other women when a prospect like Tom Seymour heaves into view. But of course she will never be 50. He wonders if this is the last time he will see her, before the courtroom. She sits down, in shadow, in the midst of the women. The tower always feels damp from the river, and even these new, bright rooms feel clammy. He asks if she would like furs brought in, and she says, "Yes, ermine. Also, I do not want these women. I should like women of my own choosing, not yours." "Lady Kingston attends you because—"
"Because she is your spy."
"Because she is your hostess."
"Am I then her guest? A guest is free to leave."
"I thought you would like to have Mistress Orchard," he says, "as she is your old nurse, and I didn't think you would object to your aunts."
"They have grudges against me, both of them. All I see and hear is sniggering and tutting."
"Jesus, do you expect applause?" This is the trouble with Boleyns, they hate their own kin.
"You will not speak in that way to me," Anne says, "when I am released."
"I apologize. I spoke without thinking."
"I do not know what the king means by holding me here. I suppose he does it to test me. It is some stratagem he has devised, yes?"
She does not really think that, so he does not answer.
"I should like to see my brother,"
Anne says. One aunt, Lady Shelton, looks up from her needlework.
"That is a foolish demand in the circumstances." "Where is my father?" Anne says. "I do not understand why he does not come to my aid." "He is lucky to be at liberty," Lady Shelton says. "Expect no help there. Thomas Boleyn always looked after himself first, and I know it, for I am his sister."
Anne ignores her.
"And my bishops, where are they? I have nourished them. I have protected them. I have furthered the cause of religion. So why do they not go to the king for me?"
The other Boleyn aunt laughs.
"You expect bishops to intervene to make excuses for your adultery?"
It is evident that, in this court, Anne has already been tried. He says to her, "Help the king. Unless he is merciful, your cause is lost. You can do nothing for yourself, but you may do something for your daughter Elizabeth. The more humbly you hold yourself, the more penitent you show yourself, the more patiently you bear with the process, the less bitterness will His Majesty feel when your name is raised hereafter."
"Ah, the process," Anne says, with a flash of her old sharpness. "And what is this process to be?"
"The confessions of the gentlemen are now being compiled."
"The what?"
Anne says.
"You heard," Lady Shelton says. "They will not lie for you."
There may be other arrests, other charges, though by speaking out now, by being open with us, you could shorten the pain for all concerned. The gentlemen will come to trial together. For yourself and my lord, your brother, since you are ennobled, you will be judged by your peers.
They have no witnesses. They can make any accusation. I can say no to it.
That is true, he concedes. Though it is not true about the witnesses. When you were at liberty, madam, your ladies were intimidated by you, forced to lie for you, but now they are emboldened.
I am sure they are.
She holds his gaze. Her tone is scornful.
In the way Seymour is emboldened. Tell her from me. God sees her tricks.
He stands to take his leave. She unnerves him, the wild distress she is keeping in check, holding back but only just. There seems no point in prolonging the business, but he says, If the king begins a process to nullify your marriage, I may return, to take statements from you.
What?
She says.
That too? Is it necessary? Murder will not be enough.
He bows and turns away.
No.
She fetches him back. She is on her feet, detaining him, timidly touching his arm, as if it is not her release she wants so much as his good opinion.
You do not believe these stories against me. I know in your heart you do not, Cranwell.
It is a long moment. He feels himself on the edge of something unwelcome. Superfluous knowledge. Useless information. He turns, hesitates, and reaches out. Tentative. But then she raises her hands and clasps them at her breast, in the gesture Lady Rochford had showed him. Ah, Queen Esther, he thinks. She is not innocent, she can only mimic innocence. His hand drops to his side. He turns away. He knows her for a woman without remorse. He believes she would commit any sin or crime. He believes she is her father's daughter, that never since childhood has she taken any action, coaxed or coerced, that might damage her own interests. But in one gesture, she has damaged them now. She has seen his face change. She steps back, puts her hands around her throat. Like a strangler, she closes them around her own flesh.
I have only a little neck, she says. It will be the work of a moment.
Kingston hurries out to meet him. He wants to talk.
She keeps doing that, her hands around her neck, and laughing.
His honest jailer's face is dismayed.
I cannot see that it is any occasion for laughter. And there are other foolish sayings which my wife has reported. She says it will not stop raining till I am released. Or start raining, or something.
He casts a glance at the window, and he sees only a summer shower. In a moment the sun will scorch the moisture from the stones.
My wife tells her, Kingston says, to leave off such foolish talk. She said to me, Master Kingston, shall I have justice? I said to her, Madam, the poorest subject of the king has justice. But she just laughs, Kingston says. And she orders her dinner, and she eats it with a good appetite. And she says verses. My wife cannot follow them. The queen says they are verses of Wyatt's. And she says, Oh, Wyatt, Thomas Wyatt, when shall I see you here with me?
At Whitehall, he hears Wyatt's voice and walks towards it, attendants wheeling after him. He has more attendants than ever he did, some of them people he has never seen before. Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, Charles Brandon big as a house. He is blocking Wyatt's path, and they are yelling at one another.
What are you doing?
He shouts, and Wyatt breaks off and says over his shoulder, Making peace. He laughs. Brandon stumps away, grinning behind his vast beard. Wyatt says, I have begged him, set aside your old enmity for me, or it will kill me. Do you want that? He looks after the Duke with disgust. I suspect he does. This is his chance. He went to Henry long ago, blustering that he had suspicions of me with Anne. Yes, but if you recall, Henry kicked him back to the East Country. Henry will listen now. He will find him easy to believe. He takes Wyatt by the arm. If he can move Charles Brandon, he can move anybody. I am not going to dispute in a public place. I sent for you to come to my house, you fool, not to go raging about in public view and making people say, What, Wyatt, is he still at large? Wyatt puts a hand over his. He takes in a deep breath, trying to calm himself.
My father told me, get to the king and stay with him day and night.
That is not possible. The king is seeing no one. You must come to me at the Rolls' house. But then,
if I go to your house, people will say I am arrested.
He drops his voice. No friend of mine will suffer.
They are strange and sudden friends you have this month. Papist friends, Lady Mary's people, Chapuis. You make common cause with them now, but what about afterwards? What will happen if they abandon you before you abandon them?
Ah, he says equably,
so you think the whole house of Cromwell will come down? Trust me, will you? Well, you have no choice, really, have you?
From Cromwell's house to the tower. Richard Cromwell as escort, and the whole thing done so lightly, in such a spirit of friendliness that you would think they were going out for a day's hunting.
Beg the constable to do all honour to Master Wyatt, he tells Richard,
and to Wyatt, it is the only place you are safe. Once you are in the tower, no one can question you without my permission.
Wyatt says, if I go in, I shall not come out. They want me sacrificed, your new friends.
They will not want to pay the price, he says easily.
You know me, Wyatt. I know how much everyone has. I know what they can afford. And not only in cash. I have your enemies weighed and assessed. I know what they will pay and what they will balk at, and, believe me, the grief they will expend if they cross me in this matter, it will bankrupt them of tears.
When Wyatt and Richard have gone on their way, he says to call me Risley, frowning, Wyatt once said I was the cleverest man in England.
He didn't flatter, call me says. I learn much daily, from mere proximity. No, it is him, Wyatt. He leaves us all behind. He writes himself, and then he disclaims himself. He jots a verse on some scrap of paper and slips it to you when you are at supper or praying in the chapel. Then he slides a paper to some other person, and it is the same verse, but a word is different. Then that person says to you, did you see what Wyatt wrote? You say, yes, but you are talking of different things. Another time you trap him and say, Wyatt, did you really do what you describe in this verse? He smiles and tells you, it is the story of some imaginary gentleman, no one we know. Or he will say, this is not my story I write, it is yours, though you do not know it. He will say, this woman I describe here, the brunette, she is really a woman with fair hair, in disguise. He will declare, you must believe everything and nothing of what you read. You point to the page, you tax him. What about this line? Is it true? He says, it is poet's truth. Besides, he claims, I am not free to write as I like. It is not the king, but meter that constrains me, and I would be plainer, he says, if I could. But I must keep to the rhyme.
Someone should take his verses to the printer, Risley says. That would fix them.
He would not consent to that. They are private communications.
If I were Wyatt, Callme says, I would have made sure no one misconstrued me. I would have stayed away from Caesar's wife.
That is the wise course,
he smiles.
But it is not for him. It is for people like you and me.
When Wyatt writes, his lines fledge feathers, and unfolding this plumage, they dive below their meaning and skim above it. They tell us that the rules of power and the rules of war are the same. The art is to deceive, and you will deceive, and be deceived in your turn, whether you are an ambassador or a suitor. Now, if a man's subject is deception, you are deceived if you think you grasp his meaning. You close your hand, and it flies away. A statute is written to entrap meaning, a poem to escape it. A quill, sharpened, can stir and rustle like the pinions of angels. Angels are messengers. They are creatures with a mind and a will. We do not know for a fact that their plumage is like the plumage of falcons, crows, peacocks. They hardly visit men nowadays. Though in Rome he knew a man, a turnspit in the papal kitchens, who had come face to face with an angel in a passage dripping with chill, in a sunken storeroom of the Vatican where cardinals never tread, and people bought him drinks to make him talk about it. He said the angel's substance was heavy and smooth as marble, its expression distant and pitiless. Its wings were carved from glass. When the indictments come to his hand, he sees at once that, though the script is a clerk's, the king has been at work. He can hear the king's voice in every line, his outrage, jealousy, fear. It is not enough to say that she incited Norris to adultery with her in October 1533, nor Breton in November the same year. Henry must imagine the base conversations and kisses, touchings, gifts. It is not enough to cite her conduct with Francis Weston in May 1534, or to allege that she laid down for Mark Smeaton, a man of low degree, in April last year. It is necessary to speak of the lovers' burning resentment of each other, of the Queen's furious jealousy of any other woman they look at. It is not enough to say that she sinned with her own brother. One must imagine the kisses, presents, jewels that passed between them, and how they looked when she was alluring him with her tongue in the said George's mouth, and the said George's tongue in hers. It is more like a conversation with Lady Rochford, or any other scandal-loving woman, than it is like a document one carries into court. But all the same, it has its merits. It makes a story, and it puts into the heads of those who will hear it certain pictures that will not easily be got out again. He says, "You must add at every point and to every offence, and several days before and after," or a similar phrase that makes it clear the offences are numerous, perhaps more numerous than even the parties themselves recollect. "For in that way," he says, "if there is specific denial of one date, one place, it will not be enough to injure the whole." And look what Anne has said. According to this paper, she has confessed, "She would never love the king in her heart. Never has, does not now, and never could." He frowns over the documents and then gives them out to be picked over. Objections are raised. Is Wyatt to be added? No, by no means. If he must be tried, he thinks, if the king goes so far, then he will be pulled away from this contaminated crew, and we will start again with a blank sheet. With this trial, with these defendants, there is no way but one, no exit, no direction except the scaffold. And if there are discrepancies, visible to those who keep accounts of where the court resides on this day or that, he says, "Breton once told me he could be in two places at once. Come to think of it, so did Weston. Anne's lovers are phantom gentlemen flitting by night with adulterous intent. They come and go by night, unchallenged. They skim over the river like midges, flicker against the dark, their doublets sewn with diamonds. The moon sees them, peering from her hood of bone, and Thames water reflects them, glimmering like fish, like pearls." His new allies, the Courtenays and the Pole family, profess themselves unsurprised by the charges against Anne. The woman is a heretic, and so is her brother. Heretics, it is well known, have no natural limits, no constraints, fear neither the law of the land nor the law of God. They see what they want and they take it. And those who, foolishly, have tolerated heretics out of laziness or pity, then discover at last what their true nature is. Henry Tudor will learn harsh lessons from this, the old families say. Perhaps Rome will stretch out a hand to him in his trouble. Perhaps, if he creeps on his knees, then after Anne is dead, the Pope will forgive him and take him back. "And I?" he asks. "Oh, well, you, Cromwell." His new masters look at him with various expressions of bemusement or disgust. "I shall be your prodigal son," he says, smiling. "I shall be the sheep that was lost." At Whitehall, little huddles of men muttering, drawn into tight circles, their elbows pointing backwards as hands caress the daggers at their waist, and among lawyers a sub-fusc agitation, conferences in corners. Rafe asks him, "Could the king's freedom be obtained, sir, with more economy of means? Less bloodshed?" "Look," he says, "once you have exhausted the process of negotiation and compromise, once you have fixed on the destruction of an enemy, that destruction must be swift, and it must be perfect. Before you even glance in his direction, you should have his name on a warrant, the ports blocked, his wife and friends bought, his heir under your protection, his money in your strong room, and his dog running to your whistle. Before he wakes in the morning, you should have the axe in your hand. When he, Cromwell, arrives to see Thomas Wyatt in prison, the constable Kingston is anxious to assure him that his word has been obeyed, that Wyatt has been treated with all honour. And the Queen, how is she?
Restless,
Kingston says. He looks uneasy.
I'm used to all sorts of prisoners, but I've never had one like this. One moment she says, I know I must die. Next moment, much contrary to that. She thinks the king will come in his barge and take her away. She thinks a mistake has been made, that there is a misapprehension. She thinks the king of France will intervene for her.
The jailer shakes his head. He finds Thomas Wyatt playing dice against himself, the kind of time-wasting pursuit old Sir Henry Wyatt reprehends. Who's winning? He asks. Wyatt looks up. That trolling idiot, my worst self, plays that canting fool, my best self. You can guess who wins. Still, there is always the possibility it will come up different. Are you comfortable? In body or spirit? I only answer for bodies. Nothing makes you falter, Wyatt says. He says it with a reluctant admiration that is close to dread. But he, Cromwell, thinks, I did falter, but no one knows it. Reports have not gone abroad. Wyatt did not see me walk away from Weston's interrogation. Wyatt did not see me when Anne laid her hand on my arm and asked me what I believed in my heart. He rests his eyes on the prisoner. He takes his seat. He says softly, I think I have been training all my years for this. I have served an apprenticeship to myself. His whole career has been an education in hypocrisy. Eyes that once skewered him now kindle with simulated regard. Hands that would like to knock his hat off now reach out to take his hand, sometimes in a crushing grip. He has spun his enemies to face him, to join him as in a dance. He means to spin them away again, so they look down the long, cold vista of their years, so they feel the wind of exposed places that cuts to the bone, so they bed down in ruins and wake up cold. He says to Wyatt, Any information you give me I will note, but I give you my word that I will destroy it once this thing is accomplished. Accomplished? Wyatt is querying his choice of word. The king is informed his wife has betrayed him with various men, one her brother, one his closest friend, another a servant she says she hardly knows. The glass of truth has shattered, he says. So yes, it would be an accomplishment to pick up the pieces. But you say he is informed. How is he informed? No one admits anything except Mark. What if he is lying? When a man admits guilt, we have to believe him. We cannot set ourselves to proving to him that he is wrong. Otherwise the law courts would never function. But what is the evidence? Wyatt persists. He smiles. The truth comes to Henry's door, wearing a cloak and hood. He lets it in because he has a shrewd idea of what lies beneath. It is not a stranger who comes calling. Thomas, I think he has always known. He knows if she was not false to him in body, she was so in words, and if not in deeds, then in dreams. He thinks she never esteemed or loved him when he laid the world at her feet. He thinks he never pleased or satisfied her, and that when he lay next to her, she imagined someone else. That is common, Wyatt said. Is it not usual? That is how marriage works. I never knew it was an offence in the eyes of the law. God help us. Half England will be in jail. You understand that there are the charges that are written down in an indictment, and then there are the other charges, those we don't commit to paper. If feeling is a crime, then I admit nothing. Norris admitted. He admitted he loved her. If what someone wants from you is an admission, it is never in your interest to give it. What does Henry want? I am honestly perplexed. I cannot see my way through it. He changes his mind, day to day. He would like to rework the past. He would like never to have seen Anne. He would like to have seen her, but to have seen through her. Mostly he wishes her dead. Wishing is not doing it. It is, if you are Henry. As I understand it, the Queen's adultery is no treason. No. But the man who violates her, he commits treason. You think they used force, Wyatt says dryly. No. It is just the legal term. It is a pretense that allows us to think well of any disgraced queen. But as for her, she is a traitor too. She has said so out of her own mouth. To intend the king's death, that is treason. But again, Wyatt says, forgive my poor understanding. I thought Anne had said, if he dies, or some such words. So let me put a case to you. If I say, all men must die, is that a forecast of the king's death? It would be well not to put cases, he says pleasantly. Thomas More was putting cases when he tipped into treason. Now let me come to the point with you. I may need your evidence against the Queen. I will accept it in writing. I do not need it aired in open court. You once told me, when you visited my house, how Anne conducts herself with men. She says, yes, 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 no. Wyatt nods. He recognizes those words. He looks sorry he spoke them. Now you may have to transpose one word of that testimony. Yes, 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 no, yes. Wyatt does not answer. The silence extends, settles around them, a drowsy silence as elsewhere leaves unfurl, May blossoms on the trees, water tinkles into fountains, young people laugh in gardens. At last Wyatt speaks, his voice strained. It was not testimony. What was it then? He leans forward. You know I am not a man with whom you can have inconsequential conversations. I cannot split myself into two, one your friend and the other the king's servant. So you must tell me. Will you write down your thoughts, and if you are requested, will you say one word? He sits back. And if you can reassure me on this point, I will write to your father to reassure him in turn, to tell him you will come out of this alive. He pauses. May I do so? Wyatt nods. The smallest possible gesture, a nod to the future. Good. Afterwards, for your trouble, to compensate you for this detention, I will arrange for you to have a sum of money. I don't want it. Wyatt turns his face away, deliberately, like a child. Believe me, you do. You are still trailing debts from your time in Italy. Your creditors come to me. I'm not your brother. You're not my keeper. He looks about him. I am, if you think about it. Wyatt says, I hear Henry wants an annulment, too. To kill her and be divorced from her all in one day. That is how she is, you see. Everything is ruled by extremes. She would not be his mistress. She must be Queen of England. So there is breaking of faith and making of laws, so the country is set in an uproar. If he had such trouble to get her, what must it cost him to be rid? Even after she is dead, he had better make sure to nail her down. He says curiously, have you no tenderness left for her? She has exhausted it, Wyatt says shortly. Or perhaps I never had any. I do not know my own mind. You know it. I dare say men have felt many things for Anne, but no one except Henry has felt tenderness. Now he thinks he's been taken for a fool. He stands up. I shall write some comfortable words to your father. I will explain you must stay here a little space, it is safest. But first I must... We thought Henry had dropped the annulment, but now, as you say, he revives it. So I must... Wyatt says, as if relishing his discomfort, You'll have to go to see Harry Percy, won't you? It is now almost 4 years since, with Call Me Risley at his heels, he has confronted Harry Percy at a low inn called Mark and the Lion, and made him understand certain truths about life. The paramount truth being that he was not, whatever he thought, married to Anne Boleyn. On that day he had slammed his hand on the table and told the young man that if he did not get himself out of the way of the king, he would be destroyed, and that he, Thomas Cromwell, would let his creditors loose to destroy him and rip away his earldom and his lands. He had slammed his hand on the table and told him further, if he did not forget Anne Boleyn and any claim he made on her, her uncle the Duke of Norfolk would find out where he hid and bite his bollocks off. Since then, he has done much business with the Earl, who is now a sick and broken young man, heavily in debt, his hold on his affairs slipping away from him day by day. In fact, the judgment is almost accomplished, the judgment he had invoked, except that the Earl still has his bollocks, as far as anybody knows. After their talk at Mark and the Lion, the Earl, who had been drinking for some days, had caused his servants to sponge his clothes, wiping away trails of vomit, sour-smelling, rawly shaven, trembling and green with nausea, he had presented himself before the King's Council, and obliged him, Thomas Cromwell, by rewriting the history of his infatuation, by forswearing any claim on Anne Boleyn, by affirming that no contract of marriage had ever existed between them, that on his honour as a nobleman he had never tupped her, and that she was completely free for the king's hands, heart, and marriage bed, on which he had taken his Bible oath, the book held by old Warham, who was archbishop before Thomas Cranmer, on which he had received the Holy Sacrament, with Henry's eyes boring into his back. Now he, Cromwell, rides over to meet the Earl at his country house in Stoke Newington, which lies north and east of the city on the Cambridge Road. Percy's servants take their horses, but rather than entering at once, he stands back from the house to take a view of the roof and chimneys. £50 spent before next winter would be a good investment, he says to Thomas Risley, not counting the labour. If he had a ladder, he could go up and look at the state of the leads. But that would perhaps not be consonant with his dignity. Master Secretary can do anything he likes, but the Master of the Rolls has to think of his ancient office and what is due to it. Whether, as the King's vicegerent in spirituals, he is allowed to climb about on roofs, who knows? The office is too new and untried. He grins. Certainly it would be an affront to the dignity of Master Risley if he were asked to foot the ladder. I'm thinking about my investment, he tells Risley, mine and the King's. The Earl owes him considerable sums, but he owes the King £10,000. After Harry Percy is dead, his earldom will be swallowed by the crown. So he examines the Earl too, to judge how sound he is. He is jaundiced, hollow-cheeked, looks older than his age, which is some 34, 35. And that sour smell that hangs in the air, it takes him back to Kimbolton, to the old queen shut up in her apartments, the fusty, unaired room like a jail, and the bowl of vomit that passed him in the hands of one of her girls. He says without much hope, "You haven't been sick because of my visit." The Earl looks at him from a sunken eye. "No, this it is my liver. No, on the whole, Cromwell, you have dealt very reasonably with me, I must say. Considering what I threatened you with." He shakes his head, rueful. "Oh, my lord, today I stand before you a poor suitor. You will never guess my errand." "I think I would." "I put it to you, my lord, that you are married to Anne Boleyn." "No." "I put it to you that in or about the year 1523, you made a secret contract of marriage with her, and that therefore her so-called marriage with the king is null." "No." From somewhere the Earl finds a spark of his ancestral spirit, that border fire which burns in the north parts of the kingdom and roasts any Scot in its path. "You made me swear, Cromwell. You came to me where I was drinking at Mark and the Lion, and you threatened me. I was dragged before the council, and I was made to swear on the Bible that I had no contract with Anne. I was made to go with the king and take communion. You saw me. You heard me. How can I take it back now? Are you saying I committed perjury?" The Earl is on his feet. He remains seated. It does not mean any discourtesy. Rather, he thinks that if he stands up, he might fetch the Earl a slap. And he has never, to his knowledge, assaulted a sick man. Not perjury, he he says amicably.
I put it to you that on that occasion your memory failed.
I was married to Anne, but had forgotten.
He sits back and considers his adversary.
You have always been a drinker, my lord, which is how I believe you are reduced to your present condition. On the day in question, I found you, as you say, at a tavern. Is it possible that when you came before the council you were still drunk, and therefore you were confused about what you were swearing?
I was sober.
Your head ached. You were nauseous. You were afraid you might be sick on the reverend shoes of Archbishop Wareham. The possibility so perturbed you that you could think of nothing else. You were not attentive to the questions put to you. That was hardly your fault.
But, the Earl says, I was attentive.
Any counsellor would understand your plight. We have all been in drink one time or another.
Upon my soul, I was attentive.
Then consider another possibility. Perhaps there was some slackness in the taking of the oath, some irregularity. The old archbishop, he was ill himself that day. I remember how his hands trembled as he held the holy book.
He was palsied. It is common in age, but he was competent.
If there was some defect in the procedure, your conscience should not trouble you. If you were now to repudiate your oath, perhaps, you know, it was not even a Bible.
It was bound like a Bible, the Earl says.
I have a book on accountancy that is often mistaken for a Bible, especially by you. He grins. The Earl is not entirely addle-witted, not yet.
And what about the sacred host? Percy says. I took the sacrament to seal my oath, and was that not the very body of God?
He is silent. I could give you an argument about that, he thinks, but I will not give you an opening to call me a heretic.
I will not do it, Percy says, and I cannot see why I should. All I hear is that Henry means to kill her. Isn't it enough for her to be dead? After she is dead, what does it matter who she was contracted to?
It does in the one way. He is suspicious about the child Anne had, but he does not want to press inquiries into who is her father.
Elizabeth? I have seen the thing, Percy says. She's his. I can tell you that much.
But if she were... Even if she were, he now thinks to put her out of the succession. So if he was never married to her mother, well, at a stroke, the matter is clear. The way is open for the children of his next wife. The Earl nods.
I see that.
So if you want to help Anne, this is your last chance.
How will it help her, to have her marriage annulled and her child bastardized?
It might save her life, if Henry's temper cools.
You will make sure to keep it hot. You will heap on the fuel and apply the bellows, will you not?
He shrugs.
It is nothing to me. I do not hate the Queen. I leave that to others.
So if you had ever any regard for her...
I cannot help her any more. I can only help myself. God knows the truth. You made me a liar as I stood before God. Now you want to make me a fool as I stand before men. You must find another way, Master Secretary.
I will do that, he says easily. He stands up. I am sorry you lose a chance to please the king. At the door he turns back. You are stubborn, he says, because you are weak. Harry Percy looks up at him.
I am worse than weak, Cromwell. I am dying.
You'll last until the trial, won't you? I shall put you on the panel of peers. If you are not Anne's husband, you are clear to be her judge. The court has need of wise and experienced men like yourself. Harry Percy cries out after him, but he leaves the hall with long strides and gives the gentleman outside the door a shake of the head.
Well, Master Risley says, I made sure you would bounce him into sense.
Sense has fled.
You look gloomy, sir.
Do I call me? I can't think why.
We can still free the king. My Lord Archbishop will see a way, even if we have to bring Mary Boleyn into it and say the marriage was unlawful through affinity.
Our difficulty is, in the case of Mary Boleyn, the king was apprised of the facts. He may not have known if Anne was secretly married,
but he always knew she was Mary's sister. "Have you ever done anything like that?" Master Risley asks thoughtfully. "Two sisters?"
"Is that the kind of question that absorbs you at this time?"
"Only one wonders how it would be. They say Mary Boleyn was a great whore when she was at the French court. Do you think King Francis had them both?"
He looks at Risley with new respect. "There is an angle I might explore. Now, because you have been a good boy and not struck out at Harry Percy or called him names, but waited patiently outside the door as you obeyed, I'll tell you something you will like to know. Once, when she found herself between patrons, Mary Boleyn asked me to marry her."
Master Risley gapes at him. He follows, uttering broken syllables. "What? When? Why? Only when they are on horseback does he speak to the purpose."
"God strike me! You would have been the king's brother-in-law."
"But not for much longer," he says.
The day is breezy and fine. They make good speed back to London. In other days, in other company, he would have enjoyed the journey. But what company would that be, he wonders, dismounting at Whitehall? Bess Seymour's?
"Master Risley," he asks, "can you read my mind?"
"No,"
says Callmy. He looks baffled and somehow affronted. "Do you think a bishop could read my mind?"
"No, sir."
He nods. "Just as well."
The Imperial Ambassador comes to see him, wearing his Christmas hat.
"Especially for you, Thomas," he says, "because I know it makes you happy."
He sits down, signals to the servant for wine. The servant is Christoph.
"Do you use this ruffian for every purpose?" Chapuis asks. "Is it not he who tortured the boy Mark?"
"Firstly, Mark is not a boy, he is only immature. Secondly, no one tortured him. At least," he says, "not in my sight or hearing, not at my command nor suggestion, nor with my permission expressed or implied."
"I feel you preparing yourself for the courtroom," Chapuis says. "A knotted rope, was it not, tightened around the brow? So you threaten to pop out his eyes?"
He is angry.
"This may be what they do where you were brought up. I have never heard of such a practice. So it was the rack instead. You can see him at his trial. You can judge for yourself whether he is damaged. I have seen men who have been racked. Not here. Abroad I have seen it. They have to be carried in a chair. Mark is as nimble as in his dancing days."
"If you say so."
Chapuis seems pleased to have provoked him.
"And how is your heretic queen now?"
"Brave as a lion, you will be sorry to learn."
"And proud. But she will be humbled. She is no lion, and no more than one of your London cats that sing on rooftops."
He thinks of a black cat he used to have, Marlinspike. After some years of fighting and scavenging, he ran off, as cats do, to make his career elsewhere. Chapuis says,
"As you know, a number of ladies and gentlemen of the court have ridden up to the Princess Mary to assure her of their services in the time which is at hand. I thought you might go yourself."
"God damn it," he thinks. "I'm already fully employed, and more than fully. It is no small enterprise to bring down a Queen of England."
He says, "I trust the Princess will forgive my absence at this time. It is to do her good." "You have no trouble calling her the Princess now," Chapuis observes. "She will be reinstated, of course, as Henry's heir."
He waits.
"She expects. All her loyal supporters expect. The Emperor himself expects. Hope is a great virtue, but," he adds, "I hope you will warn her not to receive any persons without permission from the king, or from me. She cannot stop them resorting to her. All her old household, they flock. It will be a new world, Thomas. The king will be eager, is eager for a reconciliation with her. He is a good father. A pity he has not had more opportunity to show it. Eustache."
He pauses, waves Christoph away.
"I know you have never married, but have you no children? Do not look so startled. I am curious about your life. We must come to know each other better."
The ambassador bristles at the change of topic.
"I do not meddle with women,"
not like you. I would not turn away a child. No one ever makes a claim on me. If they did, I would meet it.
The ladies do not wish to prolong the encounter, Chapuis suggests.
That makes him laugh.
You may be right. Come, my good friend, let us have our supper. I look forward to many more such convivial evenings, the ambassador says, beaming. Once the concubine is dead, and England is at ease.
The men in the tower, though they lament their likely fate, do not complain as sorely as the king does. By day he walks around like an illustration from the Book of Job. By night he glides down the river, accompanied by musicians, to visit Jane. For all the beauties of Nicholas Carew's house, it is 8 miles from the Thames, and so not convenient for evening journeys, even in these late nights of early summer. The king wants to stay with Jane till darkness falls. So the Queen-in-Waiting has come up to London, to be housed by her supporters and friends. Crowds surge about from one rumoured spot to another, trying to catch a glimpse of her, necks craning, eyes popping, the curious blocking gateways and hoisting each other up on walls. Her brothers throw out largesse to the Londoners in the hope of winning their voices for her. The word is put about that she is an English gentlewoman, one of our own, unlike Anne Boleyn, whom many believe to be French. But the crowds are puzzled, even rancorous. Ought not the king to marry a great princess, like Catherine, from a faraway land? Bess Seymour tells him, Jane is squirreling away money in a locked chest, in case the king changes his mind.
So should we all. A locked chest is a good thing to have.
She keeps the key in her bosom, Bess says.
No one is likely to come at it there.
Bess gives him a merry look out of the tail of her eye. By now, the news of Anne's arrest is beginning to ripple through Europe, and though Bess does not know it, offers for Henry are coming in hour by hour. The Emperor suggests that the king might like his niece, the Infanta of Portugal, who would come with 400,000 ducats, and the Portuguese prince Dom Luís could marry the Princess Mary. Or if the king does not want the Infanta, what would he say to the Dowager Duchess of Milan? A very pretty young widow, who would bring him a good sum also. These are days of omens and portents for those who value such things and can read them. The malign stories have come out of the books and are enacting themselves. The queen is locked in a tower, accused of incest. The Commonwealth, nature herself, is perturbed. Ghosts are glimpsed in doorways, standing by windows against walls, hoping to overhear the secrets of the living. A bell rings of itself, touched by no human hand. There is a burst of speech where no one is present, a hissing in the air like the sound of a hot iron plunged into water. Sober citizens are moved to shout in church. A woman pushes through the crowd at his gate, grabbing at the bridle of his horse. Before the guards force her away, she shouts at him,
God help us, Cromwell, what a man the king is! How many wives does he mean to have?
For once, Jane Seymour has a blush of colour in her cheeks, or perhaps it is reflected from her gown, the soft, clear rose of quince jelly. Statements, indictments, bills are circulated, shuffled between judges, prosecutors, the Attorney General, the Lord Chancellor's office, each step in the process clear, logical, and designed to create corpses by due process of law. George Rochford will be tried apart, as a peer. The commoners will be tried first. The order goes to the tower, bring up the bodies. Deliver, that is, the accused men. By name, Weston, Breton, Smeaton, and Norris, to Westminster Hall, for trial. Kingston fetches them by barge. It is the 12th of May, a Friday. They are brought in by armed guards, through a fulminating crowd shouting the odds. The gamblers believe that Weston will get off. This is his family's campaign at work. But for the others, the odds are even that they live or die. For Mark Smeaton, who has admitted everything, no wages are being taken, but a book is open on whether he will be hanged, beheaded, boiled, or burned, or subject to some novel penalty of the king's invention. They do not understand the law, he says to Rich, looking down from a window at the scenes below. There is only one penalty for high treason. For a man to be hanged, cut down alive and eviscerated, or for a woman to be burned. The king may vary the sentence to decapitation. Only poisoners are boiled alive. The court can give just the one sentence in this case, and it will be transmitted from the court to the crowds and misunderstood, so that those who have won will be gnashing their teeth and those who have lost will be demanding their money. And there will be fights and torn clothes and smashed heads and blood on the ground, while the accused are still safe in the courtroom and days away from death. They will not hear the charges till they hear them in court, and as is usual in treason trials, they will have no legal representation. But they will have a chance to speak and represent themselves, and they can call witnesses, if anybody will stand up for them. Men have been tried for treason these last few years and walked free, but these men know they will not escape. They have to think of their families left behind. They want the king to be good to them, and that alone should still any protest, prevent any strident pleas of innocence. The court must be allowed to work unimpeded. In return for their cooperation, it is understood, more or less understood, that the king will grant them the mercy of death by the axe, which will not add to their shame, though there are murmurs among the jurors that Smeaton will hang because, being a man of low birth, he has no honour to protect. Norfolk presides. When the prisoners are brought in, the three gentlemen draw away from Mark. They want to show him their scorn, and how they are better than he. But this brings them into proximity with each other, more than they will allow. They will not look at each other, he notices. They shuffle to create as much space as they can, so they seem to be shrinking from each other, twitching at coats and sleeves. Only Mark will declare his guilt. He has been kept in irons in case he tries to destroy himself. Surely a charity, as he would bungle it. So he arrives before the court intact, as promised, no marks of injury, but unable to keep himself from tears. He pleads for mercy. The other defendants are succinct but respectful to the court, three heroes of the tilting ground who see, bearing down on them, the indefeasible opponent, the King of England himself. There are challenges they could make, but the charges, their dates and their details go by them so fast. They can win a point if they insist, but it only slows the inevitable, and they know it. When they go in, the guards stand with halberds reversed. When they come out, convicted, the axe edge is turned to them. They push through the uproar, dead men, hustled through the lines of halberdiers to the river and back to their temporary home, their anteroom, to write their last letters and make spiritual preparations. All have expressed contrition, though none but Mark has said for what. A cool afternoon, and once the crowds have drifted off and the court broken up, he finds himself sitting by an open window with the clerks bundling the records, and he watches it done and then says, "I will go home now. I am going to my city house, to Austin Friars, send the papers to Chancery Lane." He is the overlord of the spaces and the silences, the gaps and the erasures. What is missed or misconstrued, or simply mistranslated, as the news slips from English to French, and perhaps via Latin to Castilian and the Italian tongues, and through Flanders to the Emperor's eastern territories, over the borders of the German principalities, and out to Bohemia and Hungary and the snowy realms beyond, by merchantmen under sail to Greece and the Levant, to India, where they have never heard of Anne Boleyn, let alone her lovers and her brother. Along the silk routes to China, where they have never heard of Henry the Eighth of that name, or any other Henry. And even the existence of England is to them a dark myth, a place where men have their mouths in their bellies and women can fly, or cats rule the Commonwealth and men crouch at mouse holes to catch their dinner. In the hall at Austin Friars, he stands for a moment before the great image of Solomon and Sheba. The tapestry belonged to the cardinal once, but the king took it, and then, after Wolsey was dead and he, Cromwell, had risen in favour, the king had made him a gift of it, as if embarrassed, as if slipping back to its true owner something that should never have been away. The king had seen him look with longing and more than once at Sheba's face, not because he covets a queen, but because she takes him back to his past, to a woman whom by accident she resembles, Anselma, an Antwerp widow whom he might have married, he often thinks, if he had not made up his mind suddenly to take himself off back to England and pick up with his own people. In those days he did things suddenly, not without calculation, not without care, but once his mind was made up he was swift to move, and he is still the same man, as his opponents will find. Gregory? His son is still in his riding coat, dusty from the road. He hugs him. Let me look at you. Why are you here? You did not say I must not come, Gregory explains. You did not absolutely forbid it. Besides, I have learned the art of public speaking now. Do you want to hear me make a speech? Yes, but not now. You ought not to ride about the country with just one attendant or two. There are people who would hurt you because you are known to be my son. How am I known? Gregory says. How would they know that? Doors open. There are feet on the stairs. There are questioning faces crowding the hall. The news from the courtroom has preceded him. Yes, he confirms, they are all guilty, all condemned. Whether they will go to Tyburn, I do not know, but I will move the king to grant them the swifter end. Yes, Mark too, because when he was under my roof I offered him mercy, and this is all the mercy I can deliver. We heard they are all in debt, sir, says his clerk, Thomas Avery, who does the accounts. We heard they were perilous crowds, sir, says one of his watchmen. Thurston the cook comes out, looking flowery. Thurston has heard there were pies on sale, says the jester Antony. And I, sir, I hear that your new comedy was very well received, and everybody laughed except the dying. Gregory says, but there could still be reprieves. Undoubtedly. He does not feel like adding anything. Someone has given him a drink of ale. He wipes his mouth. I remember when we were at Wolf Hall, Gregory says, and Weston spoke so boldly to you, and so me and Rafe, we caught him in our magic net and dropped him from a height. But we would not really have killed him. The king is wreaking his pleasure, and so many fine gentlemen will be spoiled. He speaks for the household to hear. When your acquaintances tell you, as they will, that it is I who have condemned these men, tell them that it is the king and a court of law, and that all proper formalities have been observed, and no one has been hurt bodily in pursuit of the truth, whatever the word is in the city. And you will not believe it, please, if ill-informed persons tell you these men are dying because I have a grudge against them. It is beyond grudge, and I could not save them if I tried. But Master Wyatt will not die, Thomas Avery asks. There is a murmur. Wyatt is a favourite in his household for his open-handed ways and his courtesy. I must go in now. I must read the letters from abroad. Thomas Wyatt. Well, let us say I have advised him. I think we shall soon see him here among us, but bear in mind that nothing is certain. The will of the king. No. Enough. He breaks off. Gregory trails him. Are they really guilty? He asks, the moment they are alone. Why so many men? Would it not have stood better with the king's honour if he named only one? He says wryly, that would distinguish him too much, the gentleman in question. Oh, you mean that people would say, Harry Norris has a bigger cock than the king and he knows what to do with it? What a way with words you have indeed. The king is inclined to take it patiently, and where another man would strive to be secret, he knows he cannot be, because he is not a private man. He believes, or at least he wishes to show, that the queen has been indiscriminate, that she is impulsive, that her nature is bad and she cannot control it. And now that so many men are found to have erred with her, any possible defence is stripped away, do you see? That is why they have been tried first. As they are guilty, she must be. Gregory nods. He seems to understand, but perhaps seeming is as far as it goes. When Gregory says, are they guilty? He means, did they do it? But when he says, are they guilty? He means, did the court find them so? The lawyer's world is entire unto itself, the human pared away. It was a triumph, in a small way, to unknot the entanglement of thighs and tongues, to take that mass of heaving flesh and smooth it onto white paper, as the body, after the climax, lies back on white linen. He has seen beautiful indictments, not a word wasted. This was not one. The phrases jostled and frotted, nudged and spilled, ugly in content and ugly in form. The design against Anne is unhallowed in its gestation, untimely in its delivery, a mass of tissue born shapeless. It waited to be licked into shape as a bear cub is licked by its mother. You nourished it, but you did not know what you fed. Who would have thought of Mark confessing? Or of Anne acting in every respect like an oppressed and guilty woman with a weight of sin upon her? It is as the men said today in court, we are guilty of all sorts of charges. We have all sinned. We all are riddled and rotten with offences, and even by the light of church and gospel we may not know what they are. Word has come from the Vatican, where there are specialists in sin, that any offers of friendship, any gesture of reconciliation from King Henry would be viewed kindly at this difficult time, because whoever else is surprised, they are not surprised in Rome about the turn events have taken. In Rome, of course, it would be unremarkable. Adultery, incest, one merely shrugs. When he was at the Vatican in Cardinal Bainbridge's day, he quickly saw that no one in the papal court grasped what was happening, ever, and least of all the Pope. Intrigue feeds on itself. Conspiracies have neither mother nor father, and yet they thrive. The only thing to know is that no one knows anything. Though in Rome, he thinks, there is little pretense at process of law. In the prisons, when an offender is forgotten and starves, or when he is beaten to death by his jailers, they just stuff the body into a sack, then roll and kick it into the river, where it joins the Tiber's general effluent. He looks up. Gregory has been sitting quietly, respectful of his thoughts, but now he says, "When will they die?" "It cannot be tomorrow. They need time to settle their business. And the Queen will be tried in the Tower on Monday, so it must be after that. Kingston cannot... The court will sit in public, you see. The Tower will be awash with people." He pictures an unseemly scramble, the condemned men having to fight to the scaffold through the incoming hordes who want to see a queen on trial. "But will you be there to watch?" Gregory insists. "When it does occur? I could attend them at the last to offer them my prayers, but I could not do it unless you were there. I might fall down on the ground." He nods. It is good to be realistic in these matters. He has heard street brawlers in his youth boast of their stomach, then blench at a cut finger. And anyway, being at an execution is not like being in a fight. There is fear, and fear is contagious. Whereas in a scrap there is no time for fear, and not until it's over do your legs begin to shake. "If I am not there, Richard will be. It is a kindly thought, and though it would give you pain, I feel it shows respect." He cannot guess the shape of the next week. "It depends. The annulment must go through, so it rests with the Queen on how she helps us. Will she give her assent?" He is thinking aloud. "It may be I am at Lambeth with Cranmer. And please, my dear son, don't ask me why there has to be an annulment. Just know it's what the King wants." He finds he cannot think of the dying men at all. Into his mind instead strays the picture of Moore on the scaffold, seen through the veil of rain, his body, already dead, folding back neatly from the impact of the axe. The cardinal, when he fell, had no persecutor more relentless than Thomas Moore. Yet he thinks, "I did not hate him. I exercised my skills to the utmost to persuade him to reconcile with the King, and I thought I would win him, I really thought I would. For he was tenacious of the world, tenacious of his person, and had a good deal to live for. In the end, he was his own murderer. He wrote and wrote, and he talked and talked, then suddenly at a stroke he cancelled himself. If ever a man came close to beheading himself, Thomas Moore was that man."
This ends Disc 11.